Deborah Newman Kamen.
Vice President Deborah Newman.
Treasurer. You'll notice the giddiest and happiest person in the convention is Phil Schein, who's no longer treasurer, so I don't know what that means for me. Just pay your dues so I don't have to call you. That's all I ask. Anyways, you have Micha Goodman's bio. I don't know how many people can say that they have bestsellers, two bestsellers in Israel. One is a book on Guide for the Perplexed, and another is The Dream of the Kuzari. So that's a pretty incredible thing to make a bestsellers list for. And Guide for the Perplexed is coming out in English, is that what you just told me? Very soon. So hopefully we can make it a bestseller here in the States as well. So Micha Goodman is a research fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. He has his doctorate in Jewish thought from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and directs Ein Prat, the Academy for Leadership. But I want to speak really personally for just a moment about Micha. I had the incredible privilege, along with several of the people here, of just graduating RLI 4 at the Hartman Institute. And probably the person that we spent the most time with was Micha, both in person in Israel and on webinars over the computer. It was an incredible, incredible privilege to study with you. Your intellect, your warmth, your humor, shown in everything that you did. The joy that you had from teaching American rabbis, not everybody loves to teach us. Let's just be honest about that. We're tough. We can be a tough crowd. You enjoyed teaching us, and we so enjoyed learning from you. And got a lot of High Holiday sermon material, I have to just tell you. It was not only inspiring, but, you know, practical also. Your love of the text, your enjoyment that you got to teach us, Kaplan and Heschel and you know, people that we... It was chutzpah, but it was fun. It was fun and also appreciated. But then several of us also had the privilege of traveling with you to Ein Prat. And the joy and love and excitement that we had from studying with you as rabbis who already came knowing that we loved these texts, we got to see that same joy and excitement from the young secular Israelis and the religious Israelis that are mostly finished with their army service and many of them engaging in these texts for the very first time and falling in love with them through Micha and his teaching and his inspiration and what you've created there. So whoever you are, whatever age you are, whatever your Jewish background is, there's something tremendous and wonderful to be gained by spending time with Micha Goodman. So it is my incredible privilege to welcome you here with us today.
Wow. Thank you for that. It's true. First of all, it's an honor to be here, and it's fun to be here, and it's great to be here. And that's right, teaching RLI, teaching American rabbis, is my favorite thing in the world, besides teaching Israelis. But my relationship with American Jewry is a complicated relationship. My mom was born and raised in a Roman Catholic family in Oklahoma City. And she comes from what we call a Haredi Roman Catholic family. My mom's uncle still is what we call my granduncle Jack. He used to be the personal advisor to the Pope, to John Paul. It turns out that the Pope has an advisor on davening. 13 years he used to advise the Pope what to think about when he prays. So he used to do research to try to figure, this is before Google, to figure out where are there problems in the world and where should the Pope focus his attentions on. I have another uncle, my uncle Bill, which was a priest, and another cousin, my cousin Amy, which became a nun, and another cousin, which is a charismatic preacher in Oklahoma City. I come from a very frum Roman Catholic family. And I'm sharing this when my mom is about 20. She rebels against everything that moves. And that includes everything, including religion. And she's very idealistic. She goes to volunteer for the Peace Corps. And obviously, who do you meet in the Peace Corps? a nice Jewish boy from Springfield, Massachusetts. And they volunteer together in Bolivia, and they fall in love, and she decides they want to get married. They send an email or a pigeon or whatever it was those days to Oklahoma, and the Catholic family couldn't accept because they're against intermarriage. They couldn't accept it. So they bring the frum, uncle, all the way from Rome to La Paz, Bolivia, to convince my mom not to marry my dad. There was no conversion in the cards at that moment, but she had to. But there was an idea that she shouldn't marry a Jew. My dad's a charming person. I say charming, I mean literally, he casts a charm on people that he meets, and he somehow charmed the Pope guy from the Vatican. He somehow charmed him, and he stayed there. The family joke is he was there Misadil Kiddushi. So they get married. Now here's the situation. The uncle from the Vatican accepted the marriage. The family from Oklahoma did a chelim. Didn't accept the marriage. They stopped talking to my mom, to my dad. The family myth is that 2 years later, after her parents are not talking to her because she marries a Jew, she says, you know what? What the hell? She starts learning Judaism, converts to Judaism. They come to Israel. By 1970, my older sister, Devorah, is born. And once there are grandchildren, the grandparents break. And then they start coming to Israel. When I'm born, 1974, so my grandmother is living in our house, like 2 months a year, and we go every year to Oklahoma. That's why I felt very comfortable here in Dallas. We go every year to Oklahoma to the farm, where they had a farm, and it was beautiful. And I thought that every Orthodox Israeli has a grandmother that speaks to Jesus. I thought this was normal. And I remember the contrast between my Oklahoma family and my Jerusalemite friends and everything. I remember once we were in the airport in Ben Gurion, and it was everybody were very standing in line. They were very Israeli. And we get to Oklahoma, and everybody is smiling and generous and nice. And they were so sweet and so holy. And I remember I was about 6 or 7 years old, and my father tells me, Micha, you see all those people. They are all going. That was a family secret. They're all going. So I was still learning language, so I figured the word goy means a very nice person. So, this is true. So I decided that when I grow up, one day, I'm going to be a goy. This is all true. I'm just saying. Now, I remember being a teenager in Jerusalem. I remember the contrast between my parents are so American, and my friends were so Israeli. I always felt like my parents were too American, too loud, too cheery, too, you know, American. And my tough Israeli friends. And I felt like I didn't belong. So I did everything I could to belong to my Israeli Orthodox friends. So the Christian secret, I hid. The American piece, I tried to hide. I did everything I can to be as Orthodox as I could be. And I used to speak English like this. I was Israeli. I don't know English. Those people don't know. I remember my parents came to basic training, cheering, and I was like, yes! But six, seven years ago, I realized that my American background is not something I want to turn my back to, it's something I want to embrace, but it also that my Catholic background, in some deep, mysterious way, is part of who I am. And what happened to me through Mahon Hartman is that Hartman gave me an opportunity to speak to North American Jews. So I started learning again, about North American Jews, and reading about America, and reading American philosophy, and polishing my English, and gaining my American accent again. I feel like I've been investing the past 7 years in faking an American accent. So coming here to this important conference is very exciting for me. It's very exciting for me. It's very important for me. We all know that the Jewish world is not a global world anymore. We all know that Jews aren't all over the world, and I know there's some, I mean, we all know that the Jews are located in 81% of them in two places, in North America and in Israel. And the future of the Jewish world depends on the future of the relationship between North American Jews and Israeli Jews, and it's not an easy relationship. I never feel comfortable speaking to North American Jews because I only fake it. I don't really get North American Judaism. So what I'll try to do today, learning Torah with you, I'll try to share an Israeli reflection. And I hope we'll come out of this lecture with some Torah, but also with a reflection on exciting, not trivial things spiritually that are happening in Israel today. The way I'd like to do is I'd like to study two texts. One from Masechet Tmura. A second text from Brachot, and a third text from life, that is Israel today. And I guess between every part of this lecture, so I'll open it for some questions. I'll close it very quickly so we can move on. Okay, is that a fair deal? Okay, so I'd like to start and with a comment made by David Ben-Gurion. David Ben-Gurion is not in the text here. David Ben-Gurion said that Zionism is a different kind of a revolution. It's different than the French Revolution and the British Revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Russian Revolution. Because all those revolutions are revolutions of people rebelling against a foreign ruler, a dictator that ruled over them, that robbed them from their liberty. Zionism is different, because Zionism is not only an attempt of the Jews to rebel against a foreign ruler, it's an attempt of the Jews to rebel against themselves. It's a revolution of the Jews against themselves. What he meant was that Zionism is an attempt of Jews to rebel against their collective personality as it was cultivated in the Galut. This is where a great thinker like Michal Yosef Berdichevsky comes in, saying that Zionism is not only a political revolution, meaning trying to create a state that didn't exist. It's also a therapeutic revolution, trying to create a Jew that doesn't exist. As Jabotinsky put it so harshly, Geza psychologi chadash shel Yehudim. Can you imagine that? A new psychological breed of Jews. It was an attempt to create not only a new state, but also a new Jew. And the essence of this new Jew, according to some of them, like Berdichevsky and Brenner, was that a Jew, a fearless Jew. The way they analyzed Galut is about carrying a double fear all the time. Where fear is injected into your personality. It's because you constantly fear the Goy, and the power of the Goy, and the authority of the Goy. But as Berdichevsky puts it, Jews don't only fear the Goy, they also fear God. They believe that God, the creator of the world, revealed himself to the world, and revelation was recorded in sacred texts. And the masters of those texts can tell you what to do. So you're constantly under two authorities. The authority of the European nation states, but also the authority of Halacha and the rabbis. And since Zionism is about liberation, it's ultimately about double liberation. It's about liberating Jews from the control of the Gentiles, but it's also about liberating Jews from the control, as Berdichevsky said it, of their past. He captured this in one line, Anachnu dor acharon shel Yehudim. Says Berdichevsky, Dor acharon shel Yehudim, v'dor rishon shel Ivrim. We're the last generation of Judaism, and the first generation of Ivrim, but later turned into Israelim. I like to think about this double revolution, especially the second part. Zionism attempted to create an Israeli that's not only liberated from the Goy, but liberated from his past. That part of the revolution is a part that we have to deal with, and it's my belief that Israelis are finally dealing with that part of the revolution as we're talking. And since the issue is authority, I'd like to study now a text, a Talmudic text, that deals with authority. It's a beautiful text, Masechet Tmura. It's in page 6. The Hebrew is in page 6, the English translation. Where?
Five.
It's on page 5. Yeah. So if it's okay, I'll read this in Hebrew, and if you feel more comfortable, so follow me in the translation. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda is a Amora, second generation. Very interesting rabbi. He studied both in Sura, the great yeshiva of Rav, and in Nehar De'ah, the great yeshiva in Shmuel. And this is a text that could only be written by a person that is born from two different schools, the disciple of two different rabbis, of Rav and Shmuel, of Sura and Nehar De'ah. And after that, he created his own yeshiva. After Shmuel dies, he creates his own yeshiva, Pum Tadida. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. So Rav Yehuda is carrying the tradition of his Rosh Yeshiva, Shmuel. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. 3,000 halachot nishtakhu b'imei evlo shel Moshe. Describing an intellectual tragedy that happens once Moshe dies. The death of Moshe is not only a personal tragedy, the death of a leader is also an intellectual tragedy. It's in a deep sense the death of the Torah. When Noten HaTorah dies, the Torah itself faded away. 3,000 halachot nishtakhu b'imei evlo shel Moshe. Spooky. Amru lo leYehoshua, sh'al. The people ask Yehoshua, sh'al. What does sh'al mean? Get it back. Ask God to give us the Torah that was lost. When the giver of the Torah, can you say that in English? The giver of the Torah, does that make sense? Noten HaTorah, is that translation? The giver of the Torah dies. Amar lei lo b'shamayni. These three words from Dvarim, so much quoted from Baba Metzia, from Tanuro Shel Achnai, Rabbi Yehoshua. It's quoted here by Rav Yehuda. We can't ask anymore. Once the Torah was given, can't be given again. There is no second Torah. There might be a polemic here also. Amru lo leShmuel, sh'al. A few generations later, they ask Shmuel HaNavi, maybe you could bring the lost Torah back to the world in the imagination of Rav Yehuda in the name of Shmuel. The Torah was lost all throughout those generations. Amar lehem, ele ha-mitzvot she'en ha-navi rashay lechadesh davar me'ata. Prophets are not allowed to bring halacha to the world. The only, Rambam says, the only prophet that could create laws is Moshe Rabbeinu. From that moment on, prophets can quote laws, they can't create them. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Nafra, Af chatat shemetu ba'aleha mishtakha b'yemev lo shel Moshe. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafra has a very important he had something very important, that among those 3,000 halachot, it was important for him to mention that one of them is Din Chatat Shemetu Be'aleh. It was a very, until he said that, we couldn't understand the sugya, but now we get it. It was very important to add that among the three, among all the halachot that were lost, one of them is din chatat, when you have a korban chatat, that the owner of the chatat dies in the process of, it's a sugiyah and zvachim, that's called in Masechet Yoma, around Yom Kippurim, and the classic biblical story of chatat, shemetu be'aleh, is obviously Nadav v'Avihu, that die in the process of chatat. So Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, af chatat shemetu be'aleh, mishkakha b'yimei evlo shel Moshe. Enough, that's one of the 3,000 halachot. It's important for Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha to make that comment. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha means we also know what his job was. He was a napach, meaning what? A blacksmith, that's right. Yeah. He didn't know that he's supposed to be make a living but from Torah. Amule Pinchas Shal, Amari Lo Shamaimi. They're going out from the prophetic tradition to the priestly tradition. Amule Le Rabbi Lazar, Le Lazar Shal, Amari Ela Mitzvot Shein Avir Rashai Chadesh Levar Me'ata. End of the tradition. The Torah was lost, and it couldn't have been reconstructed by prophets or priests. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Now Rav Yehuda, the same Rav Yehuda, is going to bring an alternative tradition, this time not from the Haldea, but from Surah. Not from Shmuel, but from Rav. This sugiya is expressing very clearly the great advantage of Rav Yehuda. He is a carrier of two traditions. He's a graduate of two schools. He's a disciple of two different rabbis. So after Rav Yehuda, Rav Shmuel borrows the first tradition, we have now Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, bring us an alternative tradition of the same story. בשעה שנפטר משה רבנו לגן עדן אמרו לו יהושע שאל ממני כל ספקות שיש לך. Right before Moshe dies, he tells his disciple Yehoshua, his devoted disciple, if you have any questions, any last questions right before I die, this is the time to ask. אמר לו רבי, כלום נחתיך שעה אחת והלכתי למקום אחר. I was such a devoted disciple, I never left you. כלום נחתיך לשעה אחת והלכתי למקום אחר. לא כך כתבת בי, you thought that I'm so devoted. ומשרתו יהושע בן נון, נער, לא ימיש בתוך האוהל. It's like, יהושע is offended that he has lack of certainty. I was such a great disciple, I don't have any ספקות. I only have certainty. He's offended that Moshe thinks that he might have ספקות. Miyad, now the missing piece is now Moshe dies. Miyad tashash kocho shel Yehoshua v'nishtakchu mimeno 300 halachot v'noldu lo 700 sfeikot v'amdu kol Yisrael lehorgo. Why does Israel want to kill their leader? Because he doesn't know enough Torah. Based on a true story. ועמדו כל ישראל להורגו. So for the school of Rav, they have the same tradition, but it's a different tradition. I want to stop pausing just for 1 minute and listen to the critique. It's part of the critique of Rav Yehuda on the persona of Yehoshua, Binun. Yehoshua says, I'm such a great disciple, therefore I have no doubt. That's the reason why he didn't ask anything, and that's the reason why he forgot so much and created so much doubt. Now, it's interesting the contrast in Rav Yehuda that brings this tradition and Yehoshua, the hero of that tradition. Rav Yehuda is a person that is not a disciple of one teacher. Maybe a silent criticism of the type of person that when you are a disciple of one teacher, you're dependent on that teacher, and when that teacher dies, your Torah might go away with it. This might be a critique of the tlut, of the dependency of someone on one teacher. I'm continuing. It's not only intellectual tragedy now, the loss of his knowledge created a loss of his leadership. The way Rav Yehuda is trying to remember the past is that we admire our leaders, our intellectuals, and once he lost his knowledge, he lost his leadership. ועמדו כל ישראל להורגו, אמר לו הקדוש ברוך הוא, לומר לך, אי אפשר לך. I guess they're saying, Yeshua goes back to God, give me the missing knowledge so I can reconstruct my leadership. God says to him, לומר לך, אי אפשר לך. He has a different solution. לך ותורדן במלחמה. That I have a better solution to reconstruct your lost leadership. Start a war. Lech v'tordan b'milchama. This is, as you know, the oldest trick in the book. You want to regain your lost leadership? There's nothing like a good war. You ever see the movie Michael Douglas? Kashkesh, okay, Kashkesh. Kashkesh Bakeli. Okay, now about the Anglit. Wagging the dog, right? Yeah. You have an issue, you start a war. Now, but so this radical Sugiya imagines that because the loss of Torah, we start a war. Which might be an interesting statement when Torah is lost, so violence verse out. This might be an interesting statement, but this is, but what it actually says here, and this is unbelievable. Shene'emar v'hi achrei mot Moshe eved Adonai v'yomer Hashem el Yehoshua. That's the, this is chapter 1 in the book of Joshua, where God tells Joshua to go enter Israel and conquer Israel. Meaning, according to this radical Agadita, why did we conquer Israel in the times of Yehoshua? Not because there is a mitzvah kibush ha'aretz, not because it's the dream of generations, not because of the snail boer, not because of brit ben avetarim. Why, according to this radical, the radical imagination of Rav Yehuda, why did we start that war? To restore the lost leadership of Joshua. It was the Kevin Spacey show, House of Cards. I thought it was an Israeli TV show. By the way, it's interesting that Rav Yehuda imagines Kibush Haaretz as a part, he imagines it as a cynical move by Joshua to restore his lost leadership. Yahweh doesn't really think that. In Haggadah, in Haggadot, Chazal allow their imagination to go wild. But still, it's interesting because Rav Yehuda is the anti-Zionist of the Talmud. Rav Yehuda is the one that says, "Kol olem bavel le'eretz Yisrael over ba'aseh." He thought it's asur not to have sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael. That's Shlosh HaShavuot. It's asur to go to Eretz Yisrael over ba'aseh. When his Talmud Rabbi Zeira wants to leave Bavel and to Eretz Yisrael, he has to sneak out because he doesn't want to get caught by his rabbi. Maybe is it a coincidence? The same rabbi that said you're not allowed to go to Israel and the same rabbi that's cynical about conquering Israel? Just asking. Now there's another tradition. A third one. בבתי ניתם ה-1700 קלים וחמורים וגזירות שבוע ודידוקי סופרים נשתכחו בימי אבלו של משה. Now there's another tradition trying to say, and I think this is an important part of the tradition, that what was lost wasn't only the knowledge, it was also gzeirot shavot v'kal v'chomer, meaning it wasn't only the knowledge, it was the method of lamdanut, of scholarship, of gzeirah shava, of kal v'chomer. That's what was lost in yemei evlo shel Moshe. אמר רבי אבהו, now we're going next generation of המוראים, אף על פי כן החזירן עתניאל בן כנז מתוך פלפולו. All the lost knowledge was gained back by one biblical hero, עתניאל בן כנז. שנאמר וירקדה אותי ילד נקנז אחי כלב. I guess we cut it too early. This is a great midrash. Crazy midrash. What, according to Sefer Shoftim, what city did Otniel ben Knaz conquer? Kiryat Sefer. So there's a midrash here. He conquered the book. This is a classic Talmudic move. And in Sefer Shoftim, it was a military move. He conquered Kiryat Sefer. In the imagination of the rabbis, it was a spiritual move. He conquered back the Sefer. By the way, Kiryat Sefer today is a city filled with, I mean, it's a Haredi city. I think it's back to be Kiryat Sefer. This sugya, an important sugya, is a great sugya that expresses the halachic mindset, the Talmudic mindset, the great movement from revelation to interpretation. When they couldn't restore the knowledge through prophecy or through revelation, the only way they could restore it is not asking God anymore, but turning to their own minds, to their own intellect. They're becoming their own authority. Afakichen to interpretation. Afakichen hichziran Otniel ben Knaz mitoch pilpulo. I'd like to think a little bit more. Maybe there's more here. Maybe it's more than just Afal Pichen. I want to offer one thought about the referring here to Nadav ve'Avihu and Chatat shemetu be'aleha. Why does Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, in the middle of the sugya, have to intervene with that bizarre remark that among the 3,000 halachot that were lost and after the tragedy of the death of Moshe, one of them is Din Chatat Shemetu Be'aleha? I'd like to offer a thought here. Maybe this is one of those lines of the Talmud that you have no idea why it's said and what is it doing here. And there must be a girsa where it's not. But maybe it's here for a reason. Maybe that remote, bizarre line is the key to the secret of this sugya. Chatat shemetu be'aleha nishtakcha b'imevlo shel Moshe. I'd like to zoom in to the story in the Torah where there's a chatat shemetu be'aleha, the story we all know too well. Take us Chanukat Mishkan. I'd like to move to the next page. What we have here is the peak. We don't have a lot of time, so we're going to read the peak of the ceremony. In the eighth day, in the moment which according to Chazal is Yom Kippurim. That's why it's dealt with in not only in Zvachim, but also in Yomah. After, this was after the second collective revelation. Am Yisrael in the desert didn't have only one collective revelation in Sinai, and a second collective revelation in Chanukat HaMishkan, when God appeared and the people of Israel reacted to God's second appearance, where it says Vayaronu Vayiplu Al Pnehem. Here Rudolf Otto had a great comment. Vayaronu Vayiplu Al Pnehem. Vayaronu is Milshon Rina. Kol Rina V'Yishua. Rina is joy, and Vayiplu Al Pnehem is what? Fear, terror, says Otto, in great religious moments. Paradoxical emotions appear. Joy and fear and terror at the same time. Vayaronu vayiplu apneihem. So we have God appearing, the people reacting religiously and paradoxically. And then there is Nadav v'Avihu that want more. ויקחו בני אהרון נדב ואביהו איש מחלתו ויתו בין אש לשימו להקטורת ויקריב לפני אדוני אש זרה אשר לא ציווה אותם ותצא אש לפני אדוני ותאכל אותם וימותו לפני אדוני. And the psukim we didn't bring here, the esh came out and ate the evarim that were on the mizbeach. It seems like the same esh is coming out now. This time, not to swallow the evarim, but the makrivim. But the priests, two of the priests, that bought those evarim. ואומר משה לאהרון הוא אשר דיבר אדוני לאמור בקרובי הקדש ועל פני כל העם מכבד וידום אהרון ויקרא משה למישאל ולצפן ולעוזיאל דוד אהרון ויאמר עליהם קרבו שאו את אחיכם את פני הקודש אל מחוץ למחנה ויקרבו ויסעו בקטנותם אל מחוץ למחנה כאשר דיבר משה ואומר משה לאהרון ולעזר ואיתמר בניו ראשיכם אל תפרעו ובגדיכם אל תפרומו ולא תמותו ועל כל העדה יקצוף. There's a lot to be said here on anti-climax. After collective revelation, we have a tragedy. It's a very, very biblical narrative. The narrative never, as opposed to Hollywood movies, the Bible never ends a story in the high, on the peak. After Sinai, there is an Eged. And after the people of Israel say in Har HaKarmel to Eliyahu Navi, Hashem Hu Elohim, Hashem Hu Elohim, the next day, they go back to worship the Baal Asherah. And after this moment, after the great collective revelation, after Tekes Chanukat HaMishkan, after God radiates to everyone that He's present and they react with Vayaronu Vayipluar Pnehim, we have this terrible moment. So after climax, there's anti-climax. And the second paradox here, then the most holiest place, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, we have now Avi Avot HaTumah. Why did they die? It seems like they died because they didn't go by protocol. It seems like they died because according to protocol, they weren't supposed to bring their own individual Esh Zahra. Maybe it is against religious spontaneity. It's against not going by, violating protocol. When you're in the Mikdash, there's laws, there's rules, you have to follow them. There's no room for individualism. There's no room for religious spontaneity. There's only a protocol that you have to follow. And then there is the heroic moment. Vayidom Aharon. And Moshe telling them that they can't express any expressions of what? Of grief. Why can't they? Why can't they? For the same reason that they died, you can't change the ceremony and express any sadness about them dying. They died because you have to obey the ritual, and you can't express avilut. Why? Because you have to continue obeying the same ritual. There is no room for anything spontaneous here. The show must go on. Now these lines, I don't know how they're used by sermons here in the U.S. But the Vayidom Aharon sermon is a classic Israeli sermon in Erev Yom HaZikaron. It's a classic Israeli sermon, meaning at great moments, you don't have personal grief, only collective grief. In great moments, you have to swallow your own individual pain and realize that you're not your own person. You belong to a group that's bigger than you. To the people of Israel. Vayidom Aharon. And I think there's also something even more powerful in this pasuk. When God tells them not to express any individual pain, He says to them, Ve'achichem kol beit Yisrael. Now you're representatives of the collective. You can only be attached to the pain of the collective, but your own personal pain, as a main psychological trade-off, your personal pain will be expressed by the collective. And the collective pain or issues you'll experience personally. There's a psychological trade-off here, and I don't think you have to be too sensitive to listen to what he's saying here. To Elazar v'Itamar, to the younger brothers, he's saying to them, "Ve'achichem kol beit Yisrael ivku tesrifa shasaraf Hashem." He's saying to them, "Your brothers are Am Yisrael. You have no personal brothers." Nadav v'Avihu are not your brothers. V'acheichem kol Beit Yisrael. At this moment, at this ritual, you are priests. You're a priest, you're not a father. You're priests, you're not brothers. You're people of the collective. You're not individual human beings. And therefore, you don't have the privilege for individual pain. So they asked to overcome themselves. But you don't know. By the way, is this material also for sermons here in America? Or you don't have Yom HaZikaron? But this is... There's only one problem with that sermon. I think it's textually wrong. If we continue to read how it goes on, we'll move to... I'm speeding it up, I'm moving to page 8. Part of the process is that there is a Se'il Chatat. And part of the process of the Korban Chatat is, as you know, Korban Chatat is not Kodashim Kalim, it's Kodshei Kodashim. Meaning it's one of those Korbanot that the Kohanim have to eat. And Chazal say that the eating of the Kohanim is an essential part of the Kapara. Be'achilatam Kaparatam. It's a part of the Kapara. And now they're supposed to, part of the ritual is them eating the Korban Chatat. But there's a problem with Korban Chatat. What happened with it? Nadav v'Avihu just died. Now here's a moment. I'm skipping to Pasuk Tetzayin. Are you with me? Pasuk Tetzayin. V'tzeir ha-chatat darosh darosh Moshe. Moshe asks the two brothers and their father, where's the chatat? Vehinei saraf. They burnt it. Vayktsof al Elazar v'Itamar. Elazar v'Itamar bnei Aaron l'tarim emor. Madua lo achaltem et hachatat bimkom hakodesh. Ki kodesh kodeshim hu. Ki ve'otam natan lachem aseret avon ha'edah lechaper alechem lifnei Adonai. Ve'en lo uva idamai lakodesh pnima. Echol tochlut al hakodesh ka'asher tziviti. Why is Moshe very angry? In the middle of this great ceremony, he becomes very angry. Why is he angry? For the second time in the same ceremony, they violated protocol. They didn't eat Korban Chatat. I assume that he's terrified that what will happen now? Yeah, we just got to... They weren't obedient. They don't know what to say to Moshe, but their father does. Vaydaber Aharon el Moshe. By the way, why didn't Moshe turn to Aharon to begin with? Why does he turn to his sons? Also, Aharon didn't eat the Korban Chatat. I don't know why, but sometimes it's easier when you have to yell at someone. You have to yell at the kids. So Aaron comes up, Aaron and Moshe. And he actually has an answer. And is going to tell them why they violated protocol and why against what he commanded they didn't eat the Korban Chatat. Vaydaber Aaron and Moshe, hen hayom ekrivu et chatatam ve'et olatam lifnei Adonai v'tikra'ena oti ka'ele. Something did happen today, if you didn't notice, my brother. ותקראנה אותי כאלה ואכלתי חטאת היום. You think that after everything that happened I could start eating meat now? Now I don't know why he thinks, what's the psychological link between Nadav v'Avihu dying and it's clear to him that he can't eat meat? Is it because when you're depressed you can't eat? Is it because he can't eat burnt flesh? He can't imagine himself eating Korban Chatat now. The show can't go on. Something had to change. Can't you realize that? But that's not how he's expressing it. He's expressing it differently. He says to him, Hayitav Beinei Adonai. Saying, do you think that's what God would want? Haitav b'inei Adonai? Is that what God would want? And the unbelievable ending of this parasha, Vayishma Moshe, Vayitav Beinav. Aaron is speculating, saying, I don't think this is what God wants. Haitav Beinei Adonai, and Moshe is answering, he's persuaded by his brother, but it's a different persuasion. He's not persuaded that God wants that, he realizes that that's what he wants. Vayishma Moshe Vayitav Beinav, his own eyes. This is a very unbiblical moment. I'll try to explain why. There are at least four other parallel moments where there's a halacha that they didn't know the answer. B'nos lofchad, mekoshesh etzim, mekalel, pesach sheini. These are all four precedents when something happens and they don't know what to do. What are you supposed to do with a mekoshesh? What are you supposed to do with someone who curses God? It doesn't say, and the revelation in Sinai wasn't complete. It didn't cover all the details. Pesach Sheni, somebody couldn't do Pesach. So in all these precedents, what does Moshe do? And not Lofchad. So what does Moshe do? He goes to God. He asks God. God tells them. And knows the answer. Meaning, in all these precedents, we need another revelation to complete the first revelation. To fill in the missing hole in the first revelation. Now there's another, again, now, every time, by the way, they have to go into Oel Moed, ask God, they get an answer, he comes back. God is the only posek in the Bible. Besides, this is the only time where he is not. Paradoxically. In this case, they didn't have to go to Ohel Moed to ask God because they're already there. He can just turn his head and say, Chatache metu, what are we supposed to do here? But at this moment, the only moment in the Torah, they decided not to ask God. They decided to ask themselves. Maybe this is exactly what Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Nafcha meant. Af chatat shemetu be'alea nishtakcha b'yimei Avlo shel Moshe. What we forgot in those tragedy of Yimei Avlo shel Moshe, it's not that the Torah was lost. It's that the sense of human autonomy was lost. It's that when you don't know something, you don't ask God anymore. This is a Talmudic moment inside the Bible. It's a Tanuot Shel Achnai moment inside the Bible. And it's a tremendous paradoxic moment. Because in the middle of that story, where the Pesukim are saying, you're not an individual, Aaron comes out and he says, I am an individual. In the middle of that story, where the punishment is saying, the show can't go on, Aaron is saying, but it's... The show must go on, Aaron is saying, but it can't. And at that moment where he expresses individual grief and individual pain, at that moment where he expresses his individuality, saying that the ceremony, the ritual, can't capture and erase my individuality, that's the same moment where he expresses intellectual autonomy. It's about asking myself. By the way, this is V'tzeir ha-chatat darosh darash Moshe. This is obviously not pshuto shenikra, what I'm saying now. But this is the only place in the Torah where we have a midrash. Where people are deciding to ask themselves, maybe that's what Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha is adding to this sugya. When Moshe died, that wasn't a moment where we were supposed to express our dependence on Moshe. That was the moment where we were supposed to release ourselves from the independence on Moshe. It was supposed to be a chatat shemetu be'aleha moment. That what was forgotten in Yemei Yevlo shel Moshe. This text, it's a weird text. The Shas 63 Masechtot doesn't only have these kind of sugiyot. The Talmud is filled with authority, but there's some moments where the scholars of the Talmud are reflecting, what is it that they are doing? What is the Torah about? Is it authority or autonomy? What happened in that moment when we moved from revelation to interpretation? Maybe the Nadav v'Avihu story is a moment of interpretation in the middle of the text of revelation. And in that sense, I feel this text is an important text. And I'd like to use this text in the Israeli context in a minute, but this would be a good time just to stop for a short round of questions. What's the time now?
Almost 11:30.
Okay, great. Anyone wants... Please.
We have half an hour left, so please, everybody, keep it in mind.
Just go up to the mic.
Yeah, I would just offer a slight twist to what you said. Because this is... Yitzhak Napa is pointing this out at the moment in which Moshe dies. And what Moshe did here was agree to Aharon. Mm-hmm. So it isn't about Aharon's human autonomy. It's about having a leader of a generation mm-hmm. who's willing to tell you how to navigate the law mm-hmm. and to understand that you don't really have a written text. Mm-hmm. That is, Moshe here is understanding that even his written text isn't complete, and you have to navigate the written text. And so what Yitzhak Napa is saying is, we have nobody in our generation who knows anymore how to navigate this system. Mm-hmm.
I'll move on. Okay, so I'll take...
Just one footnote. This is not the only midrash in the Torah. Michael Fishbane wrote a book back in 1984 in which he described a whole series of midrashim of later strata of the Torah from earlier strata of the Torah. So there are a lot of different midrashim in the Torah.
Inside Chamesh Chumshei Torah?
Yes.
Of Moshe Rabbeinu reading
Midrash? Yes, yes, yes. Where the later strata in Deuteronomy in particular interpret the earlier strata. It's a book he wrote in 1984. I don't remember the name, but I know exactly where it is in the shelf. But
just to pick up on the previous comment, actually Aharon here is supposed to say
mm-hmm.
and just I'd like to comment, Moshe is affirming it, but Aharon makes the decision for himself and explains it mm-hmm. to Moshe, and Moshe accepts mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. So, if Aharon normally doesn't appear in Torah,
it's supposed to say. This text, it was supposed to be a text that preaches obedience. And right at the end, it turns around saying that we're supposed to be obedient and we're supposed to obey the law, but there's certain radical moments that don't fit into any law. And those are moments of human autonomy. This paradoxic moment of planted in the sukiyah by Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, bought by Rav Yuda, the disciple of two different schools, of Surah Neharda, of Rav and Shmuel, being two different traditions. He was a person that lived in a tension between traditions. I like to think a little bit more about living in a tension between traditions, and I kind of lost the sense of time. So I guess I'll talk very quickly. I'd like very quickly to offer a comparison between, we're speaking about interpretation and revelation, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaalpeh. I want to think about the beginning moment of the Torah Shebichtav and compare it to the opening moment of the Torah Shebaalpeh. Beginnings are very important, as we know. It creates the first impression that defines the rest of the impressions. And the opening moment of the Torah, Shebichtav, we all know, Bereshit et bara Elohim et Hashamayim v'et Haaretz. A dramatic opening of the Torah. It's hard to hear the drama because we read it so many times, but if you try to erase your memory like Descartes said that a great student is a person that manages to forget everything every day. And if we could forget everything and listen to these psukim from the very beginning, Bereshit bara Elohim hashamayim et haaretz. And since we don't have time, I just want to point out one thing. It seems like the world, before the world, there was a lot of water. There was this pre-model ocean that was terrifyingly dark. V'choshech al pnei tehom. And this dark ocean, it's a terrifying picture. Is now attacked by God. V'yomer Elohim yehi or, v'yor. And now God separates. V'yavdel Elohim. He separates between the or and the choshech. V'yikra Elohim la'or yom. V'lachoshech kara laila. Those are the three acts of God. He creates light, He separates, and He calls it in names. V'yavdel Elohim. V'yikra Elohim la'or yom. V'lachoshech kara laila. Then there's a second day where He takes that ancient ocean and He splits it in two. V'yirakia v'toch ha'mayim. V'yimavdi b'mayim le'mayim. That's why the sky is blue. Why is the sky blue? Because we're living beneath an ocean. And by that, it's also very terrifying to live. We don't have to go to Tel Aviv to see the ocean. I'm a Jerusalemite, so you have to go because you're living beneath an ocean. And there's obviously the fear that we live beneath an ocean, that what will happen one day, the sky will literally collapse, and that happened once in the Mabul, and you live beneath an ocean, and the myth is that if you sin, it will collapse. Maybe that's what you call Yirat Shamayim. Now, when you have this awareness that God puts light and He separates from the darkness, and He puts the rakia and He separates between the mayim and the mayim. By the way, what is Pesach about? Kriat Yam Suf. The entire world was created when God took an ocean and tore it into two. Am Yisrael is born when an ocean is torn into two. Maybe it's like saying God's recruiting the powers of creation to create. They come back to create. Am Yisrael, I'm getting carried away here. I'm trying, but these are for your sermons. That's obviously a dramatic opening. God being omnipotent, in control of everything. Human beings being weak, standing in front of this God, experiencing their tininess, their weakness. That's the opening statement of the Torah. In the beginning, God created everything. What is the opening statement after that dramatic opening of the Torah Shabbat Yitzhak? I'd like to read from, we have here in chapter, in page 3. What's the opening statement of the Torah Sheba'al Peh? Perek Aleph Bebrachot, as opposed to Perek Aleph in Bereshit. Meimatai korin et Shema Be'arvit. That's a dramatic opening. Mishah shekohanim nichasin le'erchot betrumatan ad sof ha'ashmoa rishon ha'devrir b'liezer v'chachamim omrim ad chatzot. That's a dramatic opening. Now, you could say a lot of things here. David Hartman used to say that the Torah Shebichtav starts with a statement, Bereshit bara Elohim. The Torah Shebichtav starts with a question, Meimatai korin Shema Be'arvi. Torah Shebaal Peh Bichtav is loud and dramatic. Torah Shebaal Peh is detailed, it's technical. It starts not with a theological statement, but with a machloket. I'd like to listen more to the difference between these openings. It might help us think about the difference between these two worlds that these two texts represent. I'd like to move, because I'm running out of time, to the second Mishnah. After we ask Meimatai Korim Shema Be'arvit, the Mishnah is asking in part 2, Meimatai Korim Et Shema B'Shacharit. Now it's really getting interesting. Meimatai korim et shema b'shacharit. Okay. Now they're saying, Mishiyakir ben tchelet le'lavan. When is it morning? When is it morning or enough morning that we can start saying Shema Shel Shacharit? When is it Shacharit? When is it morning? Mishah Sheyakir Ben Tchelet Levan. As you know, there's different shades. Levan and Tchelet are pretty similar. And there has to be enough light in the world to differentiate between Tchelet and Levan when there's enough light in the world for that. And by the way, it's about when the sun is about 14 degrees beneath the horizon, there's enough sun in the world, enough light in the world to differentiate between Tchelet and Levan. When I was in the army, so we used to know when how many degrees the sun is beneath the horizon, because the question is, like, I was in a unit where we had to hide. So you're supposed to build your hiding place all night, and in the morning you're supposed to, when there's enough light to look what you built, you're supposed to go into hiding. And when there's enough light to differentiate between shades of green, that was what we did in the army. Here in the, so we knew the degrees that the sun was beneath the horizon. The Mishnah says when there is enough light in the world to differentiate between Tchelet and Levan, then it's morning. But then Rabbi Eliezer offers Ben Tchelet Lekorti, meaning when you can differentiate between white and Korti, which is closer to white, then it's morning. Meaning, what does Rabbi Eliezer do to morning? He makes it later. I see more light to differentiate between those shades. Now there's another question. Tell when is it morning? When is the window of Shacharit end? Rabbi Eliezer says, Ad Heinetz Hachama. Your window called morning, called Shacharit, called Zman Kriyat Shema, is from when the sun is like minus 14 degrees from the horizon until Heinetz Hachama. That's Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Ad Shalosh Shaot. You know what Shalosh Shaot are? You take daylight divided into 12. Everyone is a Shah Zmanit. It's not art. Shah Zmanit. Ad Shalosh Shaot. Why Shalosh Shaot? Shechem Derech Bnei Melachim La'amod B'Shalosh Shaot. Bnei Melachim, the people that, you know, the kind of people that don't have to get up in the morning for a job. So when they wake up, then it's morning. What's the machloket between Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Eliezer? Rabbi Eliezer has a cosmic criteria for what morning is. When the sun rises, it's morning. For Rabbi Yoshua, it's not a natural phenomenon. For Rabbi Yoshua, it's not when the sun rises, it's morning. For Rabbi Yoshua, it's when people wake up. Then it's morning. When the last one to wake up wakes up, then it's morning. What's the machloket between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua? And they have this machloket throughout the Talmud in different versions. In this case, in the Nevoah Shel Achnai, their machloket is, does the text have objective meaning? And Brachot is time objective? For Rabbi Eliezer, it is. It's a natural phenomenon. For Rabbi Yoshua, it's human and social. Let's put it this way. According to Rabbi Eliezer, people wake up in the morning. According to Rabbi Yoshua, when people wake up, it's morning. Do you know the Emek Rephaim scene? I would say, if I was a posek, I'm not a posek, but in the spirit of Rabbi Yoshua, when they stop in Kafit of Emek Rephaim, when they stop giving breakfast, no, I'm serious. You know, according to Rabbi Yoshua, is, you know, the Rabbi Yoshua phenomenon would look like this. You know those type of teenagers? Well, I have some friends that are 40 and they're still the same. Myself too, sometimes. You know the people that they wake up like at 11 and they say, good morning. And you're like working since 6 and you're, good morning. According to Rabbi Eliezer, that person is wrong. According to Rabbi Eliezer, if you wake up at 11, you say good morning, you're in the afternoon, buddy. According to Rabbi Yoshua, morning is something that we create. The meaning of the text according to Rabbi Yoshua is something that we create. According to Masechet Rosh Hashanah, the famous Sugiyah, Rabbi Yoshua realizes that Kedushat HaChodesh is something that we create. According to Rabbi Yoshua, mourning is something, this time it's what we create. Maybe there's a deep connection between Perek Aleph and Bereshit and Perek Aleph and Brachot. Between the opening of the Torah Shebichtav and the opening moment of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The opening of the Torah Shebichtav is about time. Vayikra Elohim la'or yom ve'lachoshech kara laila. Vayavdel Elohim. It's about creating time. And the opening of Brachot is about creating time. There's just one difference. In Torah Shebichtav, God is mavdil bin or lechoshech, bin yom lelaila. And the opening statement of Torah Shebaal Peh is, mi mavdil bin tchelet lekoti, bin tchelet lelevan. It's not God separating day from night, it's human beings distinguishing between day and night. But Rabbi Yoshua takes that one step further. It's not only us noticing that it's morning. It's even more than that. It's not noticing that it's morning, it's we are creating the sense of morning. If the opening statement of the Torah Shebichtav is about God creating the difference between day and night, the opening statement of the Torah Shebaal Peh is about human beings creating the difference between day and night. And in that sense, the opening impressions of these two textual worlds point out to the theological gulf between them. The Torah is a theocentric text. God is the posek. God creates, God controls. God tears the ocean apart and creates day and creates night. And the Torah Shebaal Peh is an anthropocentric for the most part. And it seems like human beings are inheriting all the roles of God in the open. By the way, I think the Talmud noticed the linkage between Mishnah Aleph and Bet and Brachot and Perek Aleph and Bereshit. They ask, why do they start with Mematai Kol Mishma Be'arvit and then Shacharit? Why is it the first night and then day? And the Talmud says, Mibriyato Shel Olam Ayteilei. The Talmud understood that there is a linkage. What I try to do here is think about the linkage between Brachot and Bereshit. The moment where God separates day from night, and the halachic moment where Rabbi Yoshua decides, and this is what Nifsak Le'alacha, that we're the ones who do that from now on. It's our world, our text, our Rosh Chodesh, it's our time also. I want to go back to Rav Yehuda, a disciple of two schools, two rabbis, two traditions. The difference between Perek Aleph and Bereshit and Perek Aleph and Brachot, two different worlds, two different gods, two different human beings. Rabbi Nachman Ibrislev has a drasha on the famous line from Masechet Avot, where it says, Yaakov bno omer, kol chayai gadalti ben chachamim. Kol chayai gadalti ben chachamim. There's a lot to think about that line. Rabbi Nachman asks the following question. Efo gadalti? Rabbi Nachman asks in a beautiful Hasidic drasha, Kol chayai gadalti ben chachamim. It's a person whose entire life is growing. He's asking, where did he grow? And his answer is ben chachamim. In the space that's created between scholars. So Rabbi Nachman asks, what exists always between scholars? When you open the Mishnah, when you open the Gemara, what do you always find in between scholars? There's always a machloket. Rabbi Nachman says, Sham gadalti. You don't grow from a tradition, from a rabbi. The space of growth is the space that's between them. You grow from the machloket. Sham gadalti. Rav Yehuda is a person that grew Ben Chachamim, between Surah and Nehardea, between Rav and Shmuel. I'd like to bring Rav Yehuda to this sugya also. When we ask, where can Judaism grow? In the theocentric world of Perek Aleph and Bereshit, or in the anthropocentric world of the Perek Aleph and Brachot? In the world where God is in control, or in a world where we define everything, including itself? I'd like to listen in light of that question to Rabbi Nachman again. Kol chayai gadalti ben chachamim. These are two different religious intuitions, two different human sensitivities. And maybe the electricity of the Jewish tradition always was the ability to grow between these two worlds. Kol chayai gadalti ben chachamim. I feel that as an Israeli, this is everything that the revolution called Zionism didn't completely get. That they thought that Judaism was only a world of authority, which created an impossible Israeli scene, where Israelis are playing an all or nothing game. There's very, very dominant orthodoxy, which I have a lot of respect for, where Judaism is about authority, and being religious is about obeying to that authority. And there is secular Zionism. It's about rebelling against any source of authority. Against the Goy, against God, trying to create a Nietzschean Jew that nothing can control. By the way, they were very, very successful in that. Nothing can control, nothing, no boundaries on Israelis about having no boundaries on your behavior, no artificial boundaries, not what the Goy says, as Ben Gurion says, Lo chashuv ma Goy yegidu, chashuv ma Yehudim yasu, that captures Zionism, not what Halacha says. By the way, that includes manners too. I'm serious, that includes manners too. What are manners? Artificial norms trying to create boundaries on our behavior. Creating this Nietzschean Jew is Zionism was such a successful revolution. Maybe too successful. Creating not only a new state, but also a new body language, a new personality. And playing that all or nothing game, or the world where you completely surrender to the authority of tradition, or the world where you shake off tradition in creating a new liberated Jew, Geza Psychologi Chadash Shel Yehudim, I think our tradition, our power of our tradition, wasn't choosing one world, but was living Ben Chachamim in the tension between those worlds. My sense is that young Israelis are starting to get this. That the all or nothing Israeli game, that either you completely surrender to tradition or you reject tradition, that all or nothing Israeli game is starting to end. We see that with new Israeli music. Ehud Banai, Yatar Banai, Kobi Oz, Eti Ankeri, Beri Sakharov, all these singers I'm mentioning now, these are rock stars. They're not avant-garde, challenging mainstream. They are mainstream. They are all going Jewish. It used to be that if you're in Israel and you want to listen to Jewish music, you have to go to the radio to the the Hasidic stations and you hear Yababam. Now you go to Galgalatz, which is what young Israelis listen, and you hear Jonathan Razel and Ehud Banai and Kobi Oz. Judaism became very, very, very popular. And what we're seeing in Israel, new Batei Midrash, young Israelis, like what we see in the army in Mahon Hartman, like what we see with young Israelis in Ein Prat. What we see, you mentioned my books being successful. Thank you. Great compliment. Please buy my books in English. But it's a testimony to something new happening in Israel, because the majority of the people who bought Moreh Nevuchim were secular Israelis. Something is happening, and here's not what's happening. It's not secular Israelis becoming religious. It's secularism changing from a secularism that rejects Judaism to a secularism that's not controlled by the past, like Veluchevsky said, but it's inspired by the past, like the model that Echad Ha'am wanted to offer, that wants to live in the tension between the world that I create and maybe the world that my tradition created for me. And this tension is a tension. I'm not saying that Israel is there yet, but I am saying that Israel is going there, and it could go there, and Israel might be much more interesting than we imagine. For that.